Thank you for downloading this program from the BBC. This program is part of World War One on the BBC. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/ww1.
I'm Dan Snow. Welcome to Voices of the First World War. In the years leading up to the centenary of the war, the last of those who actually experienced it have passed away. But the Imperial War Museums and the BBC had recorded interviews with many veterans to try to capture what it was like to actually be there. This series listens to those stories.
What impressions did you have of Basra?
Dirty, busy, and all the time, of course, the oil wells on the Persian side, smoking away by day and flaming away by night.
We're far from the rolling fields of the Western Front. This, after all, was a world war. In November 1914, a British Indian force occupied Basra in what's now southern Iraq. Their orders? To secure the oil fields for the Royal Navy's battleships. They then advanced north, up the River Tigris.
We marched from Amara onto Kutel Amara, a desert march, absolutely flat, absolutely without scenery, practically without vegetation, that is to say, sand, mud, mirage.
They'd now advanced almost halfway up the Tigris between Basra and Baghdad. For the British, Baghdad became the focus of an ever-widening vision.
Continually, you are seeing in front of you an inviting otherworldly city, which receded as you moved towards it.
British strategists became enthralled by the mirage of expanding their control in this region, fabulously rich in its reserves of oil. But early gains did not mean that the enemy, the Ottoman Turkish Empire, was defeated. In November 1915, the British reached Ctesiphon, just south of Baghdad, where Turkish forces inflicted a shock defeat.
The casualties at Ctesiphon were very heavy. In my battalion, we had over 35%. But in some regiments, they had over 60. And so resources were very severely strained and were very inadequate. I remember seeing the wounded coming onto one of the steamers as we went down the river. And so the retirement to Kut began.
The British went back the way they'd come, down the River Tigris. At the town of Kut al-Amara, on a loop in the river, the British stopped in early December 1915 to recover and regroup. But the Turks had rapidly encircled the town, trapping General Charles Townshend and his exhausted infantry. What followed has been described as one of the most humiliating defeats in the history of the British Army.
We were surrounded on three sides by the river. One side, we were invested by the Turks, and of course the Turks were on the river all round. Of course, in this constricted area, you were in rifle range from all round, and it was dangerous to move above ground.
Kut was a very flat place, just like a table, and we had to dig our trenches, everything under there, shell fire and artillery fire and rifle fire, machine gun fire. And I can tell you, it made us work, because the more you got down under the shelter, the safer you were.
Townshend and his men were in a desperate situation. The Turkish forces, with their German advisers, seized the opportunity to inflict a major defeat on their enemy. They blockaded the town and tried to prevent British relief forces from reaching Kut. General Townshend was led to expect additional forces diverted from the Western Front to arrive within 6 weeks. Ian MacDonald was an officer outside Kut with the relief forces.
We made fairly ineffectual attempts to get nearer and nearer to Kut.
Could you see what you were attacking?
Simply the flashes of artillery firing shrapnel.
But you couldn't see the Turkish trenches?
Oh, dear me, no. never got anywhere near.
Rations up to this time was quite reasonable. There was a fair amount of ordinary army rations in cuts, and they kept coming out of ordinary cattle. We had bread quite a lot. We had sugar, tea, different other things. Everything was quite reasonable.
A honeycomb of trenches developed in the besieged town. General Townsend calculated that there were enough supplies to maintain the garrison for a month. With rationing, the time the garrison could hold out was revised to 2 months, and later, as rescue attempts failed, to almost five. George Channer and Henry Rich were officers with the British force.
This monotonous siege went on with varying news from the south, good and bad, and we'd never been defeated before, and we'd come into Kut pretty high. But later on, naturally, we got rather depressed.
Was it difficult to maintain discipline in the siege of Kut?
Not where we were. We were on top of the men. I mean, you couldn't walk a yard without bumping into one of our soldiers.
The siege lasted, what,
147 days? 147 days, yes.
What was the worst part of that siege for you as a young 24-year-old lieutenant?
Well, I suppose the last bit, the hungry days.
General Townsend decided to cut our rations down so as we could last out a bit longer. He was quite good in telling us, so as I could last out so many more days longer, I'm afraid I've got to cut your rations down so much. And then he went off, I've got to feed you on horse meat.
How did you spend that time, that 147 days?
Goodness gracious me, don't ask me. Playing bridge, walking round the trenches, sniping the Turks, trying to catch fish in the river, anything.
Did you manage to catch fish in the river?
Well, there was a most revolting mudfish that lived just below the waterline on the bank. I mean, it made you sick to look at it. But if you caught one, we were very glad to eat it.
March is another thing we always remember for the simple reason there. We saw the relieving force towards dusk, saw their gunfire in the distance, and we naturally enough thought, well, this is the end, we'll soon be going out, but it wasn't to be. It was just the climax, and they were just making themselves back again, and they was gone.
We had 7 weeks of plenty, followed by 10 weeks of adequacy, gradually getting less and less, and finally we had 4 weeks of starvation, which was a complete hell.
The rations came down finally to 3 ounces of bread and 12 ounces of horse meat. The horse meat was very difficult to eat because some of these mules we ate had already been fed on mules themselves, and the meat was very lean and hard to digest.
The horse meat was cooked for about 2 hours, came out of the pot red, no salt, no vegetables, nothing at all in the water, only just water from the river. And when you cut it, it was just raw. Anyhow, that was, to us, a big meal. That plus the rib bones. Well, it got so bad, the senior NCO and the orderly man always getting one, that we had a bone roll. And as you went down the roll for your bone, it was ticked off, and you had one about every 5 days. You was absolutely hungry all day long, day and night. You had just like a rat in your inside, because actually you was living on yourself.
And so naturally we got thinner and weaker, and so carrying up the supplies to the front line became more arduous.
There were issues over the principle of eating horse meat. Muslim members of the Indian forces refused it. The death rate from starvation began to rise.
After they were dead, you carried them, buried them. But while they were living, you had to just stay amongst you in the trenches. Well, in the end, people got fed up. They say, why don't you surrender, really? Only we used to say that, but in our hearts, we didn't want to.
We began to give up hope of the relief at the beginning of April, because the relieving force were having some very severe battles. and they could make no headway against a strong Turkish position. About the 20th, we saw that things were coming to an end.
The British forces attempting to relieve the town suffered over 20,000 casualties, and the Turks lost approximately 10,000 men too. One final attempt at resupply by the paddle steamer Jalna failed, and all hope was lost. Townsend requested and received an armistice, pending surrender talks, on the 26th of April.
And on the 27th and 28th, we got our orders to destroy the stores. And throughout the day, I remember hearing explosions in the gun emplacements where the blocks were being destroyed.
Private Richard Bassett had been part of the relief force and witnessed the fall of Kut from afar.
And on the 29th of April, on the morning of the 29th, our colonel stood up in the trenches, and we saw the smoke rising in the sky. And our colonel, with tears running down his face, said, "They've had to surrender."
That everybody with the destroyer arms and equipment and throw it in the fire. And a lot of people didn't trouble about taking out their ammunition. They just threw the equipment in, and shots were going everywhere. We had to break the guns, rifles, with the small of the butt, take out the butts. I saw some old soldiers there really cry after having to burn their equipment and break their arms. It was really a tragic thing to do. We all felt it very much.
It wasn't a pleasant prospect to be defenceless when the Turks walked in.
And so we spent the rest of that day breaking things up and heaving them into the river.
Were you glad it was over, or do you think you personally could have held out for a bit longer?
Physically, no. We could not have kept on in line. We were useless, actually, for the last 4 weeks. As soldiers, we couldn't march. I mean, we couldn't have done anything.
For the Turks and for Germany, the end of the siege of Kut El Amara proved a significant morale booster. For the British, it was a humiliation. It was also an ominous start of a century of a hugely complex, expensive and often disastrous British engagement with the Middle East.
I remember on the 29th, the Turkish forces came up with a white flag and stopped at our front line for the signal to advance at noon. And we were hurried away from our stores, which were still smoking.
10,000 British and Indian troops were taken prisoner by the Ottoman army. The prisoners were marched up to Baghdad, many beaten along the way by their guards. The death rates would be horrifically high. Two-thirds of the 3,000 British prisoners would not survive captivity, along with half of the Indian troops. But for now, as the starving, weak men left Kut, initially there was a sense of relief.
In due course, a very well-disciplined Turkish regiment came in. They never looted anything or anybody. They almost appeared to be slightly sorry for it.
And at 3 o'clock, the garrison itself had to march out. And we marched past Halil Pasha, who commanded the Turkish army. I always remember his beautiful brown, shiny boots standing on the mound there. That was on the banks of the Tigris.
In the late afternoon, a Turkish steamer came along and took us up to the place where they were concentrating all the garrison of Kut, about 8 miles up the river.
World War I on the BBC, on TV, radio, and online.